Ja, meine sehr geehrten Damen und Herren, herzlich willkommen.
In welche Richtung bewegen wir uns eigentlich?
Also man könnte sagen, die Krise der Demokratie beginnt mit der Erfindung der Demokratie.
Was ist denn eigentlich der Normalzustand?
Das sind ganz, ganz gute und wichtige Fragen.
Was Sie behaupten, müssen Sie auch belegen können.
Was ist denn nun Demokratie?
So welcome to the Democracy Podcast. My name is Felix Heidenreich. I'm a political scientist at the University of Stuttgart. And you're listening to an English edition of a German series of podcasts on the crisis of democracy. This project is funded by the city of Stuttgart. And today we have the privilege and the pleasure to welcome Professor Christina Lafont from Chicago. In this series of talks, we address the question of the crisis and the future of democracy. And today we will talk about Christina Lafont's latest book, Democracy Without Shortcuts. So please allow me to briefly introduce our guest. Christina was born in Spain and she is Spanish. She then went to Germany and worked with Jürgen Habermas, to whom her latest book is dedicated, by the way. She published many articles and books on moral and political philosophy. So I will just name those books and texts that really caught my attention. There's, for example, her book on Heidegger's philosophy of language. The English edition is entitled Heidegger, Language and World Disclosure. It was published with Cambridge University Press in the year 2000. And it's a very, very fascinating account of Heidegger's rather enigmatic philosophy of language. And in my view, Christina Lafont really manages to put Heidegger in dialogue with the analytical philosophy here. Her main fields of research and interest are deliberative democracy, questions of politics and law, questions of how to structure the public sphere. She is also a co-editor of the Habermas Handbook, and she has published a book called Global Governance and Human Rights, the Spinoza Lectures. She was invited to the Spinoza Chair at the University of Amsterdam in 2011, and in 2012-2013 she was a fellow at the Institute of Advanced Study in Berlin. So her latest book, the book we're going to talk about today, is entitled Democracy Without Shortcuts, a participatory conception of deliberative democracy. Hello, Christina. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very excited to be here.
It is great that we can talk to each other. You're in Chicago. I'm in Stuttgart, but the sound quality is great. And I think we can get started right away. My first question is, and it's, I know it's an unfair question in a way, but I really would like to hear about your view on the crisis of democracy. I think Brexit and then the election of Trump really raised this question of what exactly is going on here. And I think 4 years later, we're asking ourselves, how serious is the situation? Is representative democracy really on the brink of collapse? And I really would like you to tell us a bit about your perspective. You're in the United States, but you're from Europe. So what is your view in this huge debate on the crisis of democracy?
Well, I mean, it's a very complex situation, so it's not easy to just reduce it to something or another. But I must say that I'm very worried about the current crisis. I grew up in Spain, as you mentioned, so I grew up in a dictatorship, in Franco's dictatorship, and ever since the transition to democracy that was quite successful in the 70s and 80s, I had taken democracy for granted, like I think most Western citizens of Western democracies do, in the sense that it never occurred to me seriously to think that democracy could not be here or around in those countries. And now for the first time, I'm really worried, seriously worried about the future of democracy everywhere. My impression is that what drives the crisis of representative democracy is that we have about 4 decades of neoliberal technocratic rule ever since the 80s. That led to the 2008 financial crisis. That brought even more austerity politics and an unprecedented increase in inequality within democratic societies that we are now realizing. And so what happened, more than anything, is a backlash in this kind of rise of populism and ethno-nationalism in most democratic societies, from the US to India, Brazil, Hungary, Poland, the UK, right? We're seeing that as a kind of reaction against technocratic rule. And the way populist leaders are presenting their positions is as promising electoral majorities to give back control to the people. And so it does sound kind of a claim for democracy, an attempt to get democracy back out of technocratic rule. However, as we should know, and it's very clear, populism is not a democratic project because it's like technocratic rule, one that is based on exclusion, on distinguishing between the real people and the enemies of the people. And so to me, the problem is that the situation right now looks as if democracies are stuck between populism and technocracy, between rule of experts and mob rule. And then citizens have only these two choices, right? Two equally non-democratic options. And I think we see that both in the US and in the European Union. I mean, probably the democratic deficits of the European Union have been obvious for decades and was been talking about, right? It's very clear that some aspect of the European project was technocratic and it was just produced beyond the reach of the national discussions where citizens had a way to influence, right? And so that was clear that this kind of technocratic European project could have a kind of like pushback or backlash from citizens feeling like abandoned. Trump's victory may have been more unexpected, but I think that in fact has very similar roots. There is a widespread perception in America and the US of lack of political representation because both parties are seen as catering to the interests of the 1%. So the Republican Party is seen as catering to the interests of the wealth elite, and the Democratic Party caters to the interests of the intellectual elite, and then the interests of the 99% of the population are simply not represented, they are excluded, they are not being taken care of, right? And so if we see that things this way, I'm not saying it's necessarily true, but this is a very clear perception of the citizenry. So if you see that in that context, then Trump's populist message can easily resonate in the middle of this type of political frustration. And so given all of this, I think I feel the urgency. I mean, this is a book written with urgency. Really, that's not how my experience of writing the book on Heidegger. That was really a scholarly book. This book really is written to citizens because I think that it's important to defend the possibility of genuine democracy as an alternative both to technocracy and to populism. And I think this is crucial. Citizens need to believe this in this time of crisis or else we will lose it.
So you just linked the crisis of democracy to the rise of neoliberalism in the early 80s, to Thatcher and Reagan. And thinking about that, it's really striking to see that Thatcher and Reagan, that's Great Britain and United States, it's Brexit and Trump.
Yes.
But if that is true, and if really the deep roots are, you know, somewhere 40 years ago, that would also mean that there's absolutely no chance to find a quick fix for this problem, that it may take decades to tackle these structural problems.
I actually believe that. I mean, I have a kind of different line of publications. You mentioned the one on human rights. All my publications on global governance and human rights are an attempt to come to terms with the problem that what neoliberalism has done and the kind of neoliberal global economy that we have has produced is, among other things, moving political action beyond national borders. And so whether we like neoliberal or not, the main thing is that where the political action is, what shapes the global economy, for example, the regulations of the global economy, is not something that can be influence at the national level, even by the most powerful countries, like say in the US, there is nothing American citizens can do with regard to how the WTO was shaped, what the IMF is doing. Like, this is just beyond national borders. And so that is the technocratic aspect of it. The bad problem is that where the action is, we don't have influence. And where we have influence, it doesn't matter. Like, yes, we can keep voting. We have rights to vote. But what we are voting about is really almost like if you could only vote in local municipalities.
Mm. Yeah.
And then you are wondering about your constitutional rights. It's like, how do I get to make sure, right?
Yeah.
And so, yes, this is going to take a long haul to fix. Either we bring the economy down so that it again can be influenced by at the national level, or we bring the capacity for political action up.
Yeah.
So that we can democratize transnational political action. And this is not going to happen overnight.
Yeah.
That you are right.
You mentioned
that. That's the problem.
Yeah. You mentioned that this book, Democracy Without Shortcut, is different from your other more scholarly publications. And you explicitly say that it is a book written by a citizen to other citizens. And reading the book, I was really struck because it sometimes really felt like a letter, you know, written from one citizen to another citizen. So I would like to ask you about your role as a political philosopher. How do you see your role in the public sphere or your work as a philosopher?
I'm really glad that you like the second personal perspective of the book, because this was really something very important to me. And the reason is because a lot of scholarship on democracy is written from the third personal perspective of an observer. It's a lot written in the political sciences, by economists, etc., right? And they just adopt that kind of scientific third personal perspective. And from that perspective, often, they just disqualify citizens. That's what basically that whole literature is about, is to show that citizens are ignorant, that they are irrational, that they are apathetic, that they are tribalistic, that they don't know what they are doing, and how on earth can we trust them with making good political decisions. And so when I read these books, really, which is all the time, because that's what I do professionally, I always wonder who the authors are. It's like, aren't they citizens or are they Martians, right? And if they are citizens like you and me, so what are the implications of what they say for their own role as citizens? It's like, what do they do the next day? It's like with Hume, right? When they leave the house and go voting, for example, or do anything political, how do they put together their scholarship and what they do? And so for me, the question is, what are we citizens supposed to do with that kind of bleak third personal image of democracy? And I mean, that has to do with the role that I think intellectuals or political philosophers ought to play in the public sphere. So it is very easy to observe institutions from the outside, highlight all their defects, which, of course, you're always going to find them, and simply leave it at that. It's like, this is just rotten. That doesn't work. Look, this can never work. Things like this, right? But for those who are participating in the institutions in question, those who share responsibility and who are invested in the success of the institution, that third personal perspective is remarkably useless. So I wanted to write the book to remind the Democrats among us, even those who do research on democracy, of what it is about the democratic ideal that is worth preserving and fighting for. We need to have that type of pushback against this third personal, impartial view of how rotten everything is, right? And also particularly to avoid the ideological message of this voter ignorance industry, who are just basically not only giving you the facts, but trying to convince citizens that we should dump democracy and that it will be much better to follow proposals that are, for example, technocratic, right? And so I think that political philosophy needs to take back that narrative, needs to really confront this very influential type of research and show, so to say, the undefended and probably undefensible normative assumptions that lie behind that type of scholarship that is extraordinarily influential. They do influence government, they influence citizens in the public sphere, right? But it's left mostly unchallenged. And so I think democracy is too important to be left to social scientists. We need an internal normative reconstruction of democracy that shows why all these defects that we find in democracy are worth removing and improving rather than dumping the whole project. Mm-hmm. And that voice is not being heard, really. If you look at the most important. Like in the last, say, 5 years or seven, right? Mm-hmm. It's all the obituary genre. How democracies die, how democracy ends, how, or like the people against democracy, all these books about like how democracy is not going to work. I think we need to hear that other voice, and citizens do need that other voice more than anybody. We are the only ones who can try to save democracy, if it's possible at all.
We have to try to save democracy, but on the other hand, you notice that attempts to save democracy and attempts to apply institutional reform is a very tricky business. There's one phrase in your introduction that struck me. You say the road to undemocratic hell might be paved by good intentions. So on the one hand, you say, okay, we have to rethink and rediscover the idea of the competent citizen. And on the other hand, we have to be really careful about, you know, messing around with our democratic institutions. What exactly do you have in mind when you think of the good intentions that might pave the way to undemocratic hell? Could you give us an example?
Sure. I mean, there are several examples, and that's also another motivation of the book. It's like, oh my gosh, I mean, we need to take the crisis seriously, but then there can be proposals for reform that could make things worse. That I believe. Let me just give you a couple of examples. There is a lot of proposals, and it makes sense, for increasing direct participation of citizens in decision-making, right? Obviously, yes. Obviously, we need that. That is even what the populists are claiming. It's very clear against the kind of technocratic rule we have. We absolutely need to engage citizens and make them participate. So one line of proposals are about citizens' initiatives and referenda. I think that the most salient example of why that could be the way to hell is the Brexit referendum. Yes, it may seem to be more democratic to let citizens make their own decisions directly, and this is how it was defended. Yeah. But I think that we all have learned from that catastrophic experiment what's wrong with assuming that very important decisions can be legitimately made by simple majority without first enabling those making the decisions to access the needed information and to have really opportunities to engage with their fellow citizens in a long conversation about the options, the consequences, the specific alternatives. You can't just have a one-off out-of-the-blue referendum where you have one option, nobody knows what it means, nobody knows what the consequences are. Like, that's not direct participation. This is just simply suicidal. And this is different from democracy, I think, right? Now, the Brexit referendum has been such a disaster that I think that this type of institutional reform that was extraordinarily popular like some years ago, like say 5-7 years ago, I think now is unlikely to be adopted by many countries anytime soon. So I think that one is off the table just because we had a real experiment in real time when it matters a lot, and we have seen how that's, and it's not that, it's not about the outcome, whether one likes the outcome or not. It's just that this has nothing to do with democracy. Whatever else it is, it's not democratic, right? Okay, so that one is not, probably off the table. The ones that I find very dangerous and motivate the last chapters of my book are those reforms that are defended as democratic, but that are geared to undermine the independence of the judiciary. Mm-hmm. And we see that in several European countries, right? They are justifying this kind of populist grounds that sound democratic, the idea that citizens need to take back control of political decisions and that has been given or left to the in the hands of unelected judges. This is not democratic. They are the elite, right? I'm trying to show in the book how the judiciary is an institution for us. We have to own it. This is not the Martians coming here and having instituted that branch of government. We need to own it. We need to understand why it's working for us. What it is about that institution that makes democracy possible, right? And then the third example I will mention, of course, because it's the elephant in the room in my book, is proposals for increasing citizen participation in so-called mini-publics, like citizens' assemblies, citizens' juries, or deliberative polls, etc. And of course, the citizens' assemblies of Ireland have been so successful that that has even boosted all the more the idea that this is how you could get genuine democratic participation. And so these mini publics are supposed to be formed by a representative sample of randomly selected citizens. And the difference with referenda is that if you have a small group, you can give them, you can brief them with really quality information. They can take the time to deliberate. They can really actually reach considered judgments. And that is why they could be making better decisions. And a lot of the deliberative Democrats are so invested in this type of projects. And it scares me. It scares me because really this type of projects are not democratic, even though those who defend them are Democrats to their bones.
To the bone.
I think that the best way to see it is with the most daring examples, those defending so-called lotocracy. That is where you can see what is the problem with that type of way of thinking, right? Those are defending that we should dismantle our representative institutions and replace them with lotocratic ones, right? They are extraordinarily dangerous because think about, for one thing, lotocracies are incompatible with elections. Either you have elections or you have lotteries, okay? So going in that direction will involve disenfranchising the citizenry, that is taking away their right to vote, and in fact, all opportunities for influencing the political process. I mean, for me, in my lifetime, it took my fellow citizens a lot of a struggle to get the right to vote in Spain, right?
In Spain, yeah.
I was 16, right, mm-hmm. when it finally was an option, right? Mm-hmm. So to me, the idea that you take away the power of the citizenry and give it to a few who are randomly selected, this is oligarchy with another name, is extremely dangerous. It's like, I can't believe some people are like tempted by that type of way of thinking.
I think many of those who claim that mini publics will help to revive democracy would argue that mini publics are there to add a new channel for citizens, not to replace elections. But maybe we can talk about the ambivalence of mini publics later on in more detail. I think we now just heard from you about all these different ways good intentions may pave the way to undemocratic hell. I would like to take a closer look at this very important distinction that also is present in the title of your book already. You talk about the shortcuts and then on the other hand about the long participatory road. And I would like you to tell us a bit more about what you exactly mean by this long road that democracy implies. What would be an example for taking the long road, or what would be an example for taking the shortcut?
Yeah, the distinction is motivated by one of the deepest aims of the book. So yes, that's why it's in the title. I wish I had made more clear in the book that I'm talking against and what I call now anti-democratic shortcuts. Not any shortcut, but the anti-democratic ones, right? And so the aim of the book in that regard is to really remind citizens that being a Democrat consists in accepting that all those subject to the law have equal rights to be their co-authors. This is the democratic commitment. And so that means that we are stuck with one another and that no one has the right to pick and choose who to exclude, right? It is like we are the citizens who are, namely all of those who will be subject to the law. They have the equal right, right? Whether we like them or whether we don't like them. Mm-hmm. And so for all their differences, what technocratic and populist attacks on democracy have in common is that they question that fundamental democratic commitment to inclusion. You really do, I mean, you have to accept that they have equal rights as you do to shape your society. Mm. And so
they actually reintroduce the distinction between friend and foe, right? That's what they do. And then they cut the idea of the citizenry in two, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's the real people versus those who do not really have the right to shape society equally, right? Because it's ours, not theirs, right? That is the problem. But technocrats think the same way. They just think there's a bunch of people, of citizens, who just are ignorant. They just don't know what they are doing, so they need to be ruled. They can rule, right? So it's very differently motivated, but both have that same aspect. Namely, if we take the shortcut, if we let some people rule, over the others will go somewhere faster. And we can lure citizens to say, hey, don't you want to get there? Let us do it. Let's bypass the citizenry, the ignorant, the whatever, the ones who don't belong. It very much depends on what line of shortcut you are defending. But basically, the idea is to say, to lure citizens to think, we can get faster where you want to go if we take the shortcut. Means if we do not do the hard work of trying to change the hearts and minds of our fellow citizens to realize they have the equal rights to be co-legislators. So if you want to go somewhere, you have to take the fellow citizens with you. You can't leave them behind. Because as I argue in the book, basically for one thing, you won't get there. Like the technocratic dream that if only the experts were to rule and make the decisions, then everything will be wonderful is extraordinarily naive. It's like, no, you don't. We have had anti-discrimination legislation in this country, for example, in the US forever, anti-racist legislation. And how has that helped? Zero. If you really want to get the actual outcome, namely that there is less racism, less discrimination, you have to go the long participatory road. You have to make sure that your fellow citizens embrace anti-racism. And then is when you will get to see the results, because they will do their part. Right? They'll we actually not take their kids to segregated schools. They won't go private schools. They won't do these things, right? And that's why you will get there. But to think that you could just, by the stroke of a pen, pass legislation by the experts, and then the society changes, it's just a bad dream, and it's a bad, very bad dream, because it's an exclusionary one, and then we get what we are seeing now, right? So in that sense, you may have the same policy objectives, but the idea is that the democratic way is the way that it takes longer in theory, right? But it does get you there, because once everybody has embraced some kind of goal, then you get there, then society gets there. And before that, just taking a shortcut doesn't get you there. That's the basic idea of the book.
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying that the place or the arena where democracy should really operate is not so much the parliament or the executive government, but is the public sphere. That's where we should really put the emphasis on. You first have to change the hearts and minds, and then legislation may follow. But doing things the other way around is just a top-down attempt that will in the end fail. Is that...
Exactly. I mean, my claim is that it is not democratic, and it won't work. So both problems, right? Because if it were only non-democratic, but it would work, maybe we could think about it. That is what epistocrats believe. I'm claiming in the book and showing with examples that it won't work, that they are the ones naive, right? They accuse deliberative democrats of being the naive ones, the ones that think that deliberation will make people more enlightened and that things will get better. And I'm like, no, but think about it. No, believing that without changing anything, with all the same attitudes, all citizens having the same racist, xenophobic, ignorant attitudes that they claim they have, right? And to then bypass legislation, make society wonderful and not discriminatory, this is the most naive thing I have heard in my life. Although they present themselves as realists, right? Was this famous book, Democracy for Realists, right, that made a splash here among political scientists, right? And the whole idea was that something like deliberative Democrats are extraordinarily naive, that there is no such thing as the capacity for citizens to deliberate and change their minds and be informed. And I'm looking at their proposal, and I'm like, well, this is the most naive, politically naive thing I have seen in my life. I mean, at least political activists know that they do have to fight it in the public sphere. They know they have to get their fellow citizens there. I mean, anyone who has been a political activist knows that. It's just that, you know, university professors are dreaming in their departments that don't get that one. But I think this has been known for anybody who has ever tried to bring about political change, that you have to really fight it out in the public sphere. Absolutely.
I wonder if, I mean, you have this Spanish experience of the transition to democracy, but I, as a German, I have, you know, not personally, of course, but in my, you know, education, we have this story in German democracy of a top-down introduction of democracy. I mean, after World War II, democracy was a top-down project. It was a project of American re-education, and It would have taken many, many years, decades to wait for the hearts and minds to change. You had to introduce a democratic constitution in a top-down manner. I wonder if those different experiences influence our views on this question.
No, I don't think so, because, yes, there are different ways of doing it, and I don't have a theory that says how revolutions should go, so mm-hmm. I'm not saying that one has to wait first for the change and then having a constitution. No, I don't think so. The difference is it doesn't matter how it came about. Like, you can have a top-down project or a up-down project, whichever way. But the thing is, how is the project supposed to work? Like, think of Germany. There were two possibilities. One is that you get a constitution and then you have like technocrats ruling it and do not engage into changing the attitudes of Germans.
Okay.
Could we have gotten democracy really without going the long road? The long road doesn't mean that while you are doing it, you have no legislation or are waiting somewhere. No, of course, you may have already a constitutional project. The idea is like, will you always and only be taking shortcuts, or will you also take care of the long road,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
We cannot exclude that part, because that is what those proposals are about. The idea is that we can keep the citizens ignorant. That is the message. It's like, you do not need to invest in becoming Democrats and changing their minds. You don't need that. You can have them. It's more like the throwing an inflatable parliament in Afghanistan or in Iraq. That is the problem. If the model is, I wish it was like in Germany, that you do take care of making sure that citizens can embrace that project. That is what matters to me.
Okay, so in this sense, the Federal Republic of Germany has taken the long road. And has, and has tried to teach it.
And that's why
citizens.
It has been successful.
Yeah. In your introduction, you outline a very interesting comparison between the emancipation of women and the participation of more citizens. And in both cases, similar arguments are raised, you claim. In both cases, you can hear people say that, you know, women were ignorant in the 18th century and in the 19th century and therefore should be excluded. And today it's citizens are ignorant and therefore should be excluded. Could you talk more about this analogy? I have never thought about it this way, but I think it's a very interesting comparison.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you like it. I thought it's because I'm like, at the moment, no one could write about women or any other minority, right, the way the voter ignorance literature writes about citizens, because that would be so politically incorrect that you just could not do it.
Yeah.
Right? You could not write a book saying that African Americans are so ignorant and so irrational that therefore they should not vote. You just cannot do that. It's extraordinary that once you go one category up and it's just citizens, then you can do it. And it's no problem at all. Nobody sees what's the problem. You can't just keep insulting them and telling us that they should be disenfranchised, basically, right? And you can get away with it. So I thought, okay, let's take the example of women to show what's wrong with that literature, right? So yes, because the thing is, that literature is based on tons of empirical evidence. That's what makes it so kind of like unquestionable, and that's why it has become the shared wisdom by all political scientists, even political philosophers, buy into that problem that we do need to worry about the ignorance of citizens. Okay. And so the example of women is perfect because the evidence was true. Women were ignorant. In fact, they were analphabet. They could not go to school. So the level of ignorance was much worse than citizens now in the 20th century, of course, right? But what we see now, and it's obvious you could not write that type of literature, is that the fact that they were in fact ignorant is no argument for the recommendation that they should be kept ignorant and let themselves be ruled by men, which is what the literature was trying to argue, right? So we now know that the fact that they had no access to education and were therefore ignorant is not an argument to keep it that way, right? Okay, so that is obvious. However, for the citizenry, it hasn't kind of like made the connection yet, right? And so if we have seen that it was not a good idea to keep women ignorant and let themselves be ruled by others, right, then it's also something citizens should not accept, right? the recommendation that we should keep citizens ignorant, which means xenophobic, racist, whatever it is, if you read that literature, they really are concerned about the attitudes of citizens, right? Irrational, tribalistic, right? The idea that we should keep them this way and have a better society is just mind-boggling. It's like, really? How do you do that, right? And the idea is that they should be ruled by others, preferably neoliberal economists. That is the idea. It's like, let the neoliberal economy rule, and then there will be economic prosperity, and then you don't need to worry about how ignorant citizens are, right? And so the message in the book in that regard is that, as with women, they had to fight for their rights. There is no free lunch. So citizens have to now fight for their rights. I mean, the way I see it is that, for all their defects, my view is that current democracies in this century represent a unique and extraordinary experiment in the history of humanity of empowering ordinary citizens so that they can have some real influence in political decisions. I'm not saying complete influence. I'm just saying this is an experiment. It has never happened before in the history of humanity that really massive ordinary citizens got some real power, right? And if we lose it, right? Those who are in the privileged position to do have that power and being still able to influence political decisions to some extent have an extraordinary responsibility not to lose it. Because if we lose it, then we could be exactly where the Chinese citizens are. I mean, I went to China last year and I was struck by the similarities, of course, with the experience I remember very vividly in Franco's dictatorship, where people realize, I mean, I'm always thinking that it's all about equality, and especially political equality, because that is my line of work with democracy. But when you go there, you realize it's all about freedom. And it's just like disheartening. And so I think that for us to be gambling with that unique experiment of having empowered citizens, if we lose it, it won't be back again. And so that is like exactly the same fight that women have. We absolutely have to fight for our rights. We need to resist. We need to make sure that those who are in a position to minimally influence that, that they do, that they are not fooled into losing it. We have to bootstrap ourselves, so to say, in this current situation and make sure we don't lose the little power we got.
Yeah. I mean, many people don't seem to be very interested in being included into the political process. And you use a term, I think, that is a bit, you know, questioned in German contemporary philosophy, I think, then it's alienation and Fremdung. So many people feel like it's not really their country or it's not really their politics, it's not their state anymore. We had this terrible incident here in Stuttgart where 500 young people attacked the police just a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And that's a common thing in France. It happens every day in France. So it's really incredible to see to what degree many people just don't feel that it's their state or their democracy. So I really would like to hear you talk about this difference between, on the one hand, identification or endorsement of the state, and then on the other hand, alienation and the feeling of it's not really my thing. I'm not interested in all of this, and they won't help me anyway. How would you conceptualize this difference?
So I think that alienation is an essential category you need to understand what is distinctive about the ideal of democracy. If you try to think like what is it that is makes exactly the ideal of democracy by contrast to, say, ideals of equality, of justice, of freedom, or many others, right?
Mm-hmm.
The question is, why does it matter whether the political decisions that we are subject to are our own, whether we can identify and feel that is our project, our political project, our country in that sense, or someone else's? Think of self-determination like a standard, like in the colonial fights, right, against colonization, right? Why did it matter to those countries to be liberated, to make their own decisions rather than be ruled by others, okay? What is about that that matters? And why is self-government more important, say, than effective government or good government or just government, right? What is it about that? And I think for that, you need the notion of alienation. I think it does track the right phenomenon. But I will get in a moment to your worry, and I think that is how you can understand why it is a worry in that, right? The contrast that I try to draw in the book is those who argue, which are a lot of them, that actually what is good about democracy is that you are treated as an equal. So it is about non-domination. It's about political equality. And I try to say that this is not, that this is of course necessary, but it's not sufficient. And lotocracy, by the way, offers a perfect example to see why you could have non-domination and still be alienated from the political project, right? Imagine you do have a lotocracy, means like you have randomly selected groups of citizens that keep changing, making decisions, right? In such a political system, it will exhibit political equality because no one could acquire more political power than others and it could not accumulate it, right? Because it will keep changing. So there will be non-domination. However, most people will have no idea about why they are following those laws rather than the others. They will have no idea whether the decisions that are being made in this kind of random way really track reasons that they can accept, that they can see and identify with and say, hey, this is my political project. Yes, that's why I'm doing this thing or that thing because I think it's right, because I can identify with it. Right? So that is the part where I think alienation or non-alienation is essential. However, as you will have seen, because I distinguish that in the book, I say that there are two dimensions or aspects of alienation. One is the one I call identitarian, and the other is the one that I call the justice aspect. So the identitarian aspect means that you can feel alienated of a social world if it does not reflect your values, your favorite lifestyles, your conception of the good. And then you are alienated because it doesn't show up in the way in which you care about things. It doesn't kind of like track your values, okay? This type of alienation is unavoidable, for there is no way to organize a social world such that all forms of life and all values and all conceptions of the good are equally affirmed. There is no such possibility because there is a plurality of forms of life, etc. And therefore, citizens that insist on imposing their favorite values and conceptions of the good on others are obviously illegitimate in their feelings of alienation and frustration. And I do not recognize my country, because for them what it takes to recognize my country is that it is exactly affirming my values and my conception of the good at the expense of those of others. That is how you see the difference between whether someone is a Democrat or not.
Yeah.
Right? So that is that part where feelings of alienation may be there, but they are illegitimate. Means if you transform them into claims, you can see that those claims cannot be justified. However, the situation is different when the laws and policies to which citizens are subject fail to conform to their judgments of justice. That is what I try to make clear in the book. Because if you feel alienated because you are required to wrong yourself or others because fundamental rights are being violated, that is a different kind of claim. This is a generalizable one. It's not about my conception versus the others, mine should prevail. It's about we are all engaging in brutal injustices and therefore we should do something. Right? That is a different kind of alienation, is the one that matters the most. It's the one that the constitutional project is supposed to track, right? That no one is forced to wrong themselves or others, to engage in great injustices. This type of alienation is the one that tells you that you are not in a democracy, because if that's what's going on, this is simply not working, right? And here you can have cases where people think that the fact that we are not doing anything against climate change is going to be generating a lot of injustices. The fact that, I mean, you can be alienated also when you care about the level of injustice that you are perceiving, and at the same time you realize that there is nothing you can do about it. And that is the part where I was referring before. So I think there is a lot of frustration in Europe by citizens that realize that the reason why it's not their project, basically, is because they cannot in any way influence it. It doesn't matter what you vote at the local level. That's not how you fight climate change, say, or whatever, or now the pandemic, or whatever it is. You see what I'm saying? Like, you can be alienated by realizing that you do not actually have real influence, even though you have these beautiful rights to votes, but they don't track any important decisions.
Yeah. And I suppose you would agree that the shortcuts contribute to this alienation. The shortcuts are what makes this alienation grow and what makes it stronger. So maybe we could take a brief look at the different kinds of shortcuts. We already talked about the expertocratic shortcut, about neoliberalism, about the experts in the economy, in wherever. We also briefly talked about the micro-deliberative shortcut, about the ambivalence of many publics. But there's another shortcut you talk about in the book, and that's the procedural shortcut. I thought this was very interesting because, you know, in my German world, the procedure is, in a way, the opposite of a shortcut. There's this famous book by Niklas Luhmann about legitimation by procedures, where he argues that what is so great about procedures is that it makes things more complicated. And, you know, procedures, for example, in the judicial system, prevent an unfair or a fast trial. But in your interpretation, the procedural shortcut is something rather different. Could you tell us more about what exactly the procedural shortcut is in your view?
Sure. I'm referring to a particular one, of course, as you point out. The procedural shortcut that I'm referring to in the book concerns specifically majoritarian procedures. And so it's a procedural shortcut in the context of democracy only. And so the idea is that citizens should accept majoritarian decisions, even if they substantively disagree on their merits, because of the intrinsic virtues of the procedure. So it's a pure majoritarian view that says, look, democracy is what is specific about democracy is the fact that it can resolve disagreements in a fair way. And so the idea is that we are disagreeing deeply on values, on conceptions of the good, etc. And those disagreements are not going to be just overcome. And so therefore, what is fair about democracy is that it has a procedure, that it has intrinsic value, that is intrinsically fair. Because a majority rule, under the assumption of one person, one vote, treats everyone equally. So you know you are being fairly treated because you got your voice at the table, you have an equal voice, right? And you have equal chances of influencing the outcome. And then the procedure treats you with respect, right? And so if that is the case and we cannot overcome disagreements, then the only fair way to resolve them is by running this type of fair procedure. And it's a shortcut because it's very fast, right? You just simply make majoritarian decisions and hope that everybody will accept them for the Luhmannian reasons, because it's legitimation through procedure. So it is legitimate because of the intrinsic value, even though from a substantive point of view, on the merits, it may be catastrophic decisions. I mean, they may be the most unfair thing you have seen in your life. Mm. You should accept it because, after all, you were treated as an equal, right? And then, of course, the comparison, what will make it much longer is precisely what this type of argument or defense of democracy is arguing against, which is judicial review. What will make it longer, as Luhmann knows, is if you try to go the judicial way of legally contesting those cases where, yes, you were treated fairly in the procedure, but at the same time, the decision substantively treats you or others extremely unfairly. It wrongs you or wrongs others or removes your fundamental rights, right? A majority can easily undermine rights of minorities. And so in that case, thinking that this is democratic is what I'm trying to fight against. And the idea that you can get through that shortcut because it's faster, you can get the results easier if only you convince people that it doesn't matter what they are asked to do and obey. They should only focus on the fact that they were able to vote for it, right? It's like, yeah, try that. I don't think it's going to work. Again, it's an attempt to think that we can take a shortcut and get somewhere faster. It's like, you know, if you do not bring your citizens behind, if they do not agree substantively on what they are asked to do, it's not going to happen, and it's wrong, and it's not democratic because it's exclusionary. It's excluding minorities for the sake of consolidated majorities.
Mm. So the procedure then replaces deliberation and the changing of hearts and minds. And, okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we only have a few minutes left, but I think we should absolutely talk about the European Union. You mentioned this topic already, and I think you have a very interesting perspective because you are a citizen of the European Union and you live in the United States. And I really wonder, what your view is, I mean, from the inside on the one hand, and then on the other hand, from the outside, living in Chicago, the European Union has become, I don't know how to put this in proper terms, you know, the specter or the ghost they're fighting. They're so passionate about destroying the European Union. And maybe they do have a point when they argue that the European courts decide on a very dubious reason, on very complex political questions. There's, for example, Dieter Grimm from Berlin, who argues that we really have to rethink the idea of the European Union fundamentally. So what is your view on the European Union? What would the long road of democracy look like applied to the European Union?
I think, I mean, for the purposes and in the context of this conversation, because of course the future of the European Union is a very complex topic, but in the book I defend that citizens have to be able to own their constitutional project. And I think that constitutional courts and Supreme Courts can be a piece in that puzzle, that they help to constitutionalize the discourse about what rights we have and what is the scope of our rights and freedoms. And that is something I defend, and I even defend transnational courts. However, I'm referring all the time in the book to constitutional projects, the typical democratic constitutional democracy projects where they have a Bill of Rights, right? Mm-hmm. And that is what citizens are trying to kind of really determine through the processes of discussion about them. The case of the European Union is very different. And so I do believe in the role, the fundamental role that transnational courts even, but also national courts can play in helping citizens to own their constitution. But of course, a constitutional project and the constitutionalization of legal norms can only be as good as the content of the project itself. And there I completely agree with Dieter Grimm that the European Union project of creating a common market led to give kind of priority, constitutional priority, to the four freedoms, market freedoms, and competition law against the possibility of actually determining what should be the scope of the fundamental rights of European citizens, particularly social rights, for example, right? And so the reason why citizens cannot own the constitutional project is not because there are European courts. No, it's because of the mandate that those courts have. It's the content of the constitutional project that is the problem, that does not let citizens freely determine the scope of their constitutional rights and freedoms as European citizens. And so the case of the European Court of Justice is a problem because constitutionalizing the primacy of market freedoms and competition law is a questionable political project from a democratic perspective, precisely because it does not let citizens to actually constitutional their political discourse about their fundamental rights, their social rights, etc. And so, in short, a European participatory constitutionalism of the kind that I'm defending in the book will require, in my opinion, a new foundation of the Union on the basis of a constitutional project in which competition law and market freedoms are not prioritized. It can be the aim of that constitutional project just to create a common market, no matter what, no matter the political consequences, no matter how what happens to social rights, etc. That's not going to work. And so I think we have to go beyond the treaties. We need a new constitutional project that looks more like national constitutional projects look with regard to having all fundamental rights and freedoms of citizens up for determination through public discourse through the citizens themselves, right, rather than having already a kind of prioritization of a neoliberal project. I mean, that's my view. But this is a view as a European citizen. I mean, not as a scholar. I mean, I'm not a scholar of European law, but I feel very strongly about the need to have that political project rather than what we have.
Mm-hmm. I'm afraid at the moment the European Union seems so deeply in trouble and, you know, busy trying to control all the crises coming along, that there's no initiative to really rethink or reestablish.
I mean, at this particular second, and with the pandemic, obviously it's not going to happen, but if you look at some developments, like the social charter of social rights, like This is something like you cannot hold your breath with Europe. You know that, right? It's a long haul. And I think when we saw passing the social charter of social rights of European citizens, that's not the way to do it, probably. It may not have teeth, but it shows you what is clearer in the mind of citizens and many politicians about what the deficits are, right? I mean, it's the same sense that neoliberalism has failed. And so that could help us in the long term to get there. So I'm not extraordinarily optimistic, and I'm also not holding my breath. So I don't think it's going to happen very soon. Nothing in Europe ever happens fast. But I think it's not impossible in the sense that this is very clearly what European citizens will require to really embrace and endorse the European project. And so sooner or later it will have to happen, or it will just be a failed project. That's kind of the two options I see.
Great. Thank you so much. Last question. I think the German edition of Democracy Without Shortcuts will be published with Suhrkamp, maybe coming out this year already, or...
Next year. It's coming next spring.
Next spring, okay.
It's supposed to, but
what are you working on at this moment? Is there anything we can be excited about to read from you in the coming months or years?
Well, I mean, in the coming months, I have been extremely busy writing replies of people who have written articles and special issues in journals about the book. And so I'm working on this, I like a lot, really. So one is going to come out in the Journal of Deliberative Democracy now in August. And Habermas has written a piece too.
Great.
And this is wonderful. I mean, it's excellent. It's all deliberative Democrats really reacting to the book. And so I wrote a very long reply. So it's going to come out in August. Then there is another in Holland. The journal is called Crisis. And it's also a special issue on the book. And I'm writing the replies. And there are more coming up in philosophy and social criticism is going to be another one, etc. So I'm in the short term working on that. And I think that explains the book much more. So I'm very excited. Those are not replies where I just explain what I say in the book. Not at all. I'm expanding it, and because they force me. They're asking me very difficult questions. So if anybody's interested in the book, all this engagement in the special issues are really just thinking through the issues, not just about the book, but really like about the democracy and deliberative democracy and participatory democracy, etc. But my kind of long-term project that I hope to start working more, but I have been working on it for 10 years already, but is what I point out at the end of the book, that what we need is a global participatory democracy. And so I'm hoping to write a book on human rights, because human rights is kind of the name for me for the constitutional project of the international community as a whole. And so then it's a way of trying to think, how can we have a constitutional project going that is for all of humanity? And this is my book on human rights, but that is going to take a long time.
A long time.
Even though I have been writing on it a lot, but it's not going to come out anytime soon. But that's what I'm working on.
The long and difficult road again.
That's a much, it's longer and harder.
Another long road. Okay, so thank you so much. It was a great pleasure. I hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you, Jess. It's wonderful. Yeah.
And we are happy to hear from you soon. And maybe I can put the references to the special issues you mentioned in the show notes, so everybody can check it out.
Oh, sure. If you want me, I can send them to you.
Yeah, that sounds good.
I don't know whether they're anywhere.
Okay.
I'll do that.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much. It was
bye.
Great.
Goodbye.
Okay, bye.
Dies war eine Folge des Demokratie-Podcasts, produziert vom Stadtpalais Stuttgart. Am Mikrofon war Felix Heidenreich. Und für die technische Umsetzung danke ich Jens Baumgart vom Studio Stutt.io hier in Stuttgart.